the odds just seem insurmountable, and then they get even worse.
You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow, Brandon
Sanderson, Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Taylor Adams.
Revolutionary quantum teleportation device promises to bring humanity one step closer to the stars until it fails spectacularly. The Translocator from M.G. Heron, available now on audible.com. Go to mgheron.com/ASP. Archaeologist Eliana Fisk is ripped from Earth while the whole world watches. She lands on a strange new world inhabited by a lost tribe of ancient Mayans, meeting them, getting first-hand exposure to age-old customs and rituals. It seems like an archaeologist's dream. But what if the rituals have a darker meaning? What if the god these people pray to is no god at all? And how in the world will she ever get back home? Thus begins a pulse-pounding race against time that hurls Eliana into a great unknown, revealing ancient technologies and marvelous mysteries more outlandish than she ever imagined. The Translocator is an action-packed sci-fi thriller perfect for fans of Stargate, The Atlantis Gene, and other archaeology-inspired science fiction adventures. Pick it up today. Go to mgheron.com/ASP. That's mgheron.com/ASP. The Translocator by M.G. Heron. Welcome to Author Stories. Find archives of all the shows at HankGarner.com, and while you're there, never miss an episode by subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, and YouTube. It's free on all platforms. Out today, Book 3 of the Saga of the Iron Dragon, the conclusion of the epic series that began with the Dream of the Iron Dragon. 9th century Iceland, three explorers from the far future have a daunting mission. To save humanity, they must build a craft capable of reaching the stars. The Voyage of the Iron Dragon is the concluding book in the Iron Dragon trilogy. The Iron Dragon trilogy is being produced as part of the phenomenally successful Saga of the Iron Dragon Kickstarter, which raised over $10,000. Meticulously researched and packed with action, The Dream of the Iron Dragon is a must for sci-fi and alternate history fans. Also, Book 2, The Dawn of the Iron Dragon, is available now from audible.com. There's a link to it in the show notes. Also, thanks to Josh Hayes and Richard Fox for sponsoring the show with their series Terra Nova Chronicles. Books 1 and 2 are out now. Book 3 is coming very soon, and you can get books 1 and 2 combined on audible.com, narrated by the one and only Luke Daniels. If you're a fan of the Ember War series, this continuation is one that you are going to want to have on your Kindle, in paperback, or in audiobook. Grab it now, books 1 and 2, and be ready for book 3. Also, thanks to Rick Partlow for sponsoring the show. With his book Glory Boy, Caleb Mitchell had to give up his home to save it. Shunned by friends and family, abandoned by the love of his life, he left his world to go to the academy and train to fight in a looming war against an implacable alien threat. The fleet turned him into an enhanced super soldier designed to put the fear of God into aliens who think their emperor's God, asked to sacrifice his humanity to protect his people. But when his home world is threatened, will Caleb throw away his career and risk everything to save the people who turned their backs on him? If you're a fan of Starship Troopers or Altered Carbon, jump into the world of future super commandos and star-spanning galactic war with Glory Boy. From Rick Partlow. There's links to all of our sponsors in the show notes. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am really excited to have Taylor Adams on the show with me. Taylor has a new book called No Exit, and it is available everywhere right now when you're hearing this. It's available in hardcover and audiobook and Kindle edition, and any way that you listen to or read books, you can find No Exit. This book is an amazing read. I've had it for, I was trying to think, about a month and a half or 2 months now, and the cover immediately grabs you, and the title is a really interesting play on words that we will talk about as the show unfolds, I'm sure. Taylor, welcome to the show, and happy release day.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you. You know, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Ooh, that is a really good question. I can see why you ask that. I was about five, and my parents had – it was one of those little things where I think it's a company, and they send you – a bunch of blank pages and you fill them out. It's for kids. And then you send it back to them and they bind it up into a picture book. And, you know, 5 year old me just loved that. And so I'm wondering, I should probably release this on social media because my parents just scanned PDFs of it to me. But, you know, from 5 year old me, it was it was called The Train's Worst Day. And it was basically just a story about a train that could not get home and just had all manner of natural disasters happening. So pretty much every page was, you know, oh, forest fire, oh, volcano.
Well, you know, they say that the way to write an engaging story is to create a character that people care about and then torture them. So it sounds like you got that down pretty quickly.
I think so.
That's amazing. I talk to a lot of people who have this kind of early awakening experience where they come to realize that books are made by people and that they don't just kind of come out of the ether and just materialize, but someone wrote the book and worked lovingly on it. And then, you know, that kind of is a barrier breaker for a lot of kids to realize that this is a craft that if someone else can work on it, I can work on it. And sounds like that your experience of having your parents give you this kit that allowed you to make your own book, that had to be a formative experience.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think I was just kind of addicted to that ever since. And, they really encouraged me and kind of nourished that whole process. And, I just kept working at it and kept trying and just whenever I could.
That's so cool. Were you a big reader as you continued, in your youth and into high school and into college?
You know, when I was younger, actually, I don't know if I was that big of a reader. I remember when I was little, I really devoured, like Encyclopedia Brown and those.
Oh my God, my favorite series as a kid.
They made me feel so dumb, but they were great.
Absolutely.
And then, I read a lot of Dean Koontz. I loved Dean Koontz. And then I think around high school, I decided, I really want to make, I want to make movies. And so I started focusing really on screenwriting. And then in college, I majored in film, you know, with an emphasis on screenwriting. And after college, wound up going back to, maybe I want to write books. And my ultimate goal is to do both, because I think they're both really cool forms of storytelling.
Absolutely. And, you know, I believe that storytellers are born, and that there's some gene, there's something about people that kind of makes them natural born storytellers. And then when you kind of realize that, then you can work on the specific craft of storytelling. And then some people become writers, some people become filmmakers, directors. You know, then it's kind of putting a point on it, if you will. I love that you're intrigued by both, by filmmaking and by fiction writing. Do you see any commonalities in the two where there's overlap in writing novels and making movies?
Yeah, I mean, if anything, there might be too much overlap, especially I know, you know, I came out of college and I did a little bit of, you know, PA work in the movie industry. And with a focus on screenwriting, I mean, it's a very, you know, it's all structure, it's all economy, it's all, you know, don't waste a single sentence and be very crisp. And it was really tricky going from that mindset to trying to write my first book, where I definitely think I went through a phase where I mistook being just like really bare bones for being,
right,
you know, very punchy and brief. And I definitely had to relearn, like, okay, take a little more time to set the scene, because there's just too much white space on the page.
Right, right. And that's one of the most glaring things that hits you at first when a lot of novel writers read screenplays. I think there's a lot to learn from dialogue, especially.
Totally.
You know, because in the screenplay, that's what your focus is dialogue. It's how these people are going to be interacting and then what the actors can then do with that. And those are important things for I think novel writers to study. I think we can learn a lot from it. But the most glaring thing is how much white space is on the page. And you sometimes get a line or two of description, and that has to kind of set the stage, because then the director is going to interpret that. And then, you know, he or she is going to have people that then help them, interpret that into the actual setting, and all that becomes a very visual thing. But as a novel writer, we don't get that luxury. We don't have someone else who's going to bring their vision to it and create physical sets and things like that. So as you started realizing that and realizing there is a difference, between economy and needing to, you know, to put flesh on the bones, if you will, what are some of the things that you use to help you develop that skill as a novel writer?
Really, my first book it's very much about the setting that it's in. It's Eyeshot. It's a thriller about a husband and wife that are pinned down by a sniper in the Mojave Desert. So I think I was able to, just by researching the environment and researching the, you know, the circumstances of what the story is supposed to be about, that really helped me get, really excited to just keep working on the story and make it as good as I could make it. But also, I think that was where a lot of the heavy lifting for setting the scene came from, was just looking at pictures of the desert. We don't have a whole lot of desert here in Washington State, but the eastern side of Washington, there's a little bit of desert. So I tried to get a feel for the landscape and just kind of finding little bits of the story wherever I could really helped me flesh it out. Because, yeah, like you said, it was like, oh, wow, I have to be the set designer and everything else.
Right. What drew you to the desert for that? Being from Washington State, I'm from Mississippi, and I think there's a lot of similarities in that our state is very green, very lush, very, you know, in parts of Washington State are dense forest, and that's what we have too. And, it's hard for me to channel desert. I think because that's been my experience for so much of my life. What drew you to the desert for that story? Did that story just demand to be in the desert?
Pretty much. It was kind of, yeah, just the demands of making the premise work, that the idea of being completely pinned down. So I needed a landscape that would have no trees and no rocks and no cover. So, you know, it would just kind of reinforce just the simplicity of the standoff and kind of limit the options.
Right. Right. What was it that drew you to thrillers? I mean, other than Encyclopedia Brown, mysteries and I think that was kind of early crack for a lot of mystery and thriller readers later in life. But what kept drawing you into the genre?
Man, I don't know. I think whether it's books that I really like or movies that I really like, the thing that gets me most fired up about storytelling, I think, is that intensity of just when a story just has this wonderful sense of momentum and just every beat just barrels into the next and you just can't stop. And for some reason, that is just so exciting to me. And I love situations where, or stories where the odds just seem insurmountable and then they get even worse and it just keeps escalating. And thrillers are kind of the best way for me to, the best excuse for me to do that a lot.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Are there any other genres that you like to read and kind of geek out on that, that don't necessarily fit the, you know, the thriller or crime story or psychological mold that, that might surprise people?
You know, I mean, definitely horror, but horror and thriller are very close.
Yeah, they're pretty close cousins.
Yeah, I do kind of like creature features or kind of high concept sci-fi. I think that's always really fun too.
What about your film work? What kind of stuff are you making there?
Mostly it was, let's see. And I Feel Fine was a dark comedy. So I guess I do like dark comedies too. That's another one that I like. And I Feel Fine. It was a film class project that we had to adapt a short story into a short film. And I chose, because we had a couple that we could choose, and I chose Stephen Crane's The Upturned Face.
Nice.
And yeah, and I turned it into a, with NF You'll Find, it's like a 10-12 minute dark comedy about the end of the world. And it's the last day, it's just a few hours before the unknown incident happens, whatever it is. And everybody's already lost hope. And the main character's sister just kind of preempts it and kills herself. And he is just hell-bent on honoring her properly and having a funeral. And he's trying to rally a disinterested world to do that. So in the spirit, it was kind of an adaptation of The Upturned Face in terms of the idea, the central idea, obviously not the setting or the specifics.
Right. When you're writing fiction, there seems to be, I don't know. I've talked to several filmmakers and they're not shy about talking about influences a lot of times. This was influenced by that. This is kind of a nod to this. And novelists don't necessarily talk in those kinds of terms all the time. There's kind of a, I don't know, it's stigma is not the right word, but it's like we're afraid to talk about the things that influenced us the way that filmmakers are. Do you see that separation at all? And do you see that as being something that should separate filmmakers and fiction writers?
You know, I don't know if I've ever seen that separation. I mean, I know I can say definitely Stephen King is a huge influence. I love Stephen King. I read a lot of Dean Koontz. I remember Dean Koontz's novel Intensity was a huge, I read that when I was maybe 10, but I remember just how much of an eye-opening aha moment that was, because up until then I had never seen a story that all took place over the span of maybe a day.
Right.
And I was like, oh my gosh, you can do that. That's really cool.
I've talked to a lot of actors, that have gone on to write fiction. And, you know, there seems to be this, this thing about like, frustrated actors or people in that process, that when you go to write fiction, you have complete control over the project. Whereas, filmmaking or television is very much a collaborative process. There are people with more input than you. And even if you are the screenwriter, a lot of times there are people that have kind of override, editing powers and there may be parts of your story that get clipped out or added to or whatever. But, and the same with being a novelist, there are other people with input to your story as well. But do you feel that, that writing novels is more freeing in that sense of having near complete control?
I think so. I mean, definitely at first when it's just you and the idea and the computer and a whole lot of coffee and a whole lot of mornings, I really enjoy that. It gets more collaborative as the project goes into its later phases, and you have to kind of bring beta readers in and then you bring in editors and everything. And I really enjoy the collaboration there, but I do remember going from, a screenwriting mentality to a, I'm going to write a book mentality. And I remember it was so freeing to be like, this is all on me right now. Like, I can figure it out as I go.
Right.
So I definitely see what you mean.
So after that first novel, where did you go from there?
Let's see. The first novel after I Shot, I wrote a ghost story called Our Last Night, and I was pretty wild with mixing genres on that one, just because I, you know, had never tried that before, and I wanted to try it. And so I ended up with something that's kind of part horror, part sci-fi, part romance, and very weird, but, you know, a book that I'm pretty happy with.
And go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, and then I was just going to say, I remember coming after that one, because that was a very difficult book to market, obviously, being five genres. Coming back from that, I was like, okay, I should probably try and do something that is easy to position to the market, similar to how I Shot was. And that was what made me really careful about the next premise that I chose, which was No Exit.
Well, that's a great topic that you brought up, because as writers, we are usually attracted to all sorts of types of stories. I love thrillers. I love psychological thrillers, crime thrillers. That's kind of my meat and potatoes. You know, I can pick up a thriller and read just about any time, anywhere. But I also love science fiction and fantasy, and I'm kind of all over the place. But when I sit down to write a project, I have to be really careful to keep my tropes in check, because sometimes it makes perfect sense in your head, and readers are like, what is he doing? What kind of book is this? You know,
like, what do you even put on the back of that book? How do you explain it?
Right. What shelf do you put it on at Barnes and Noble? You know, there's
exactly.
We'll buy five copies and we'll just spread them around the store.
Yeah.
Yeah. You brought it up first. I was going to ask you about the kind of multi-genre thing, but you said that you ran into troubles marketing and just didn't know what to do with the book. How did you publish that book?
It was through a small publisher in the UK, Jaffe Books. They are amazing. They actually published all three of my books, and then No Exit was later. The North American rights were bought by William Morrow. But Jaffe Books has been my go-to, and they're just wonderful. They have a very strong emphasis on, I would say, crime thrillers. So I'm most of what I write is really at home there. But with Our Last Night, it was a very just different kind of book from what their reader base was expecting, and it was just kind of a weird project that I tried.
Well, how did you get connected with them? A lot of American writers wouldn't know or think to go to a foreign publisher.
It's actually pretty weird, because I had just finished I Shot, and I was at that phase where it was like, okay, I better build out a big Excel list of agents to query. And I was doing that, and I think I hadn't sent a whole lot of queries, but I had started to, you know, I'd sent out the first wave and I was getting rejections and just, you know, powering through it. And then I read a book that I really liked, an ebook. It was called Beneath the Watery Moon by Betsy Reevely. And that was produced through Jaffe Books. And I liked the look of their, I liked the look of their covers. I liked the look of their site. And I just was like, sure, why not try sending a query? And I did that, and I'm so glad I did.
Yeah. Well, we're glad you did too. So coming off of Our Last Night, you really went into No Exit with intention.
Yes.
I hate asking people, you know, where do your ideas come from? Because, you know, ideas are everywhere. But there's something about that idea, you know, there's usually 20 story ideas just floating around. If you just open your eyes and ears and just pay attention to the world, you know, stories just pop up. But there's something about that one story that just really stands out from the others, and they almost come alive. I think you probably understand what I'm talking about, when that thing that just kind of that aha moment. When that happens to you, is it normally a character that pops up? Is it a setting? Is it a plot device? How do they usually begin to unfold for you?
Normally, I'll usually keep just kind of a whole big junk drawer of ideas, and they're half-formed ideas. They're, you know, chunks of a story, and I will just, in my spare time, just mash them together to try and see if I get a combination of spare parts that sounds like it could be a cool premise. And with No Exit, it was, okay, rest stop, cool setting. I like the idea of a rest stop, you know, plus witnessing a crime. And then that was kind of where that came from, plus Blizzard. Yeah, it's definitely, it's an aha moment for sure. I think I would definitely describe it as finding a situation more than finding a character or finding a plot device, just finding and maybe that's just me because I tend to write really small scale stories. I like very situational stories where the development of the situation is the story itself.
Yeah.
So coming up with a situation with really built in tension, that was kind of the point where I was like, okay, I'm going to work on this. I like this.
So, as it starts developing, where do the characters come in? And, Darby Thorne, gets caught in this blizzard. Where do the characters start coming in, and when do you start seeing them enter the story?
Usually the characters are pretty much the next step, because then it's like, okay, what is a good, interesting entry point for this situation? You know, who would the reader identify with? And so in the case of Darby, it was, I wanted somebody who would have a kind of a satisfying, a little bit of a redemption arc, but also just sort of emerge from normalcy. I mean, she never thinks that she's capable of anything that she does throughout the second half of the story in particular, but I find those kinds of stories really exciting. I like stories about ordinary people just rising to the occasion.
Right.
And I think that kind of sums it up.
Well, Darby's one of those characters that, like you said, ordinary people that rise to the occasion. And she's one of those characters that you just want to root. And you know, and like we talked about earlier about, you know, making a character people like and then kind of torturing them. You give Darby plenty of torture in this book. you know, metaphorically, mostly.
Mostly.
And we're just going to leave it at that. Do you, you know, when you're writing this, do you ever think, oh, this is just too much. I've done too much to Darby. Or do you kind of keep pushing the characters and seeing how they respond in your imagination?
I definitely had points where I was like, maybe this is a little too cruel and maybe this is just not going to be fun to read.
Right.
And I could have pushed it further, and I think that could have been bad for the overall product. It's really cool. There's a certain bit, I don't want to, I'll try and talk around spoilers, but there's a certain injury that happens in the final third, and that was a pretty late addition to the, it was like the fourth draft or so that I added that. And it was just because there wasn't, I felt like I was running into a problem where I couldn't escalate any further than a certain point. And it felt like the last third was lacking a little bit of oomph in a decision that she makes. And so in that case, it was kind of like, I need more torture. What's a, you know, what's a way that I can escalate it further?
Right. That's a really good point. I like how you said that you go to a point, but you're worried that it won't be fun to read.
Yeah.
How do you determine when too far is too far? And I wonder what it is, kind of in the reader's mind that when the line is crossed, because I can think of lots of books with protagonists that just go through hell. And we still want to know what happens. And even, you know, in like Stephen King's Misery, for instance, this character, that was what popped in my mind when you said that. It's literal torture, yet we still just want to know what's going to happen. And we're still rooting for this character. I wonder where that line is. And, have you ever seen the line, and gone too far and had to dial it back?
I don't know if I've ever, I'm sure I've accidentally nudged really close to the line before. And that's something that beta readers or just getting a second opinion is so valuable toward. And same thing also with characters, just getting an extra brain to respond to the story and make sure that the empathy is going where I need the empathy to go, that, you know, Darby makes some, a goal of mine was to make Darby make some mistakes also, because I feel that making mistakes and then having to push past them is a really cool trait in a hero. And, boy, making mistakes with having your hero make mistakes is a great way, if you get that balance just wrong, to totally turn the reader against them. So that was one area where beta readers were like, nope, she's too dumb. Turn that around.
That there's nothing worse than your character's too dumb.
Yeah.
That's taking the commonplace and magnifying it instead of making a commonplace hero.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, No Exit is available everywhere now, when folks are hearing this. But, you know, we're recording this right before launch, and No Exit is sitting on Amazon with over 3,000 reviews before launch. what is that pressure like, you know, counting down the clock, but knowing that people have read it and are talking about it like this?
It's crazy. I'm super excited. I'm excited to have it in front of even more readers. I'm definitely a little bit nervous. It's not quite as scary as I think the scariest part so far of doing this that I've experienced is when a book is brand new and I just have no idea how it's going to be received. So at least with this one, I've seen enough of the response that it's like, okay, I know some people are going to like it for these reasons and some people are going to dislike it for these reasons, and everybody's right. And I can kind of, you know, I feel like I know how it's going to be received, but when something is just brand new and it's like, I don't know if this is any good, and you're just sending it out for the first time, that is terrifying.
Well, and it's sitting on the Amazon most sold list, on Amazon charts. I think when I checked it earlier, it was like number 17 or, let's see. Yeah, number 19. Although it's in the top 20.
I think that might be from 2017, because it was in the Amazon charts back then before William Morrow bought it.
Well, I think we're gonna see a similar thing here on launch with this.
I sure hope so. That would be amazing.
It is primed to explode, I think, at this point. You know, after three books, to see a book have this much steam built up and making, you know, getting in front of so many people and having so many people talk about it. What do you think that you learned with this book, from when you started? How have you changed as a writer throughout this process?
Oh man. You know, it's tough to narrow down any one thing that I've learned. Actually, I know one thing. So when it launched back in June of 2017, my publisher, Jaffe Books, they did a great job of marketing it, and it performed very well. And there was the movie deal with Fox that happened a couple months later, and there was just a lot of really cool developments. It was like just an onslaught of really cool developments, and it was super exciting. But the downside is I allowed myself to get distracted by a lot of that, and I wasted a couple months that I honestly should have just been spending finding another premise to write. And, you know, I'm hard at work on my next book now, but man, I'd be done with it right now if I hadn't wasted those months back in 2017, early 2018. So I think that's the big lesson, is just never, ever stop writing. Even when there's cool stuff happening, like put in your 1,000 words a day.
Well, the weird thing that nobody likes to talk about before you find success is that when you find success as a writer, there are many things that creep into your life that take up a lot of your time that have nothing to do with writing. And it's so easy to get distracted, like you said. How do you protect your time and guard that time so that you know, the good news isn't as distracting as the bad news. And you just section that away to keep writing. How do you protect that?
For me, I definitely like to write just as early in the morning as possible just to get it done. And I think I'm definitely a morning person. I feel like I'm more alert in the mornings. I think as the day goes along, I get more and more distractible. So for me, if I can just preserve that momentum and wake up and get a lot done, then the rest of the day I can be distractible and enjoy all the other stuff. But, you know, for example, I have a day job in Seattle, and so I take the Sounder. And so that's like a guaranteed hour in the morning that I can just focus on writing on the train, and then a guaranteed hour in the evening, which is awesome. But sectioning that time off and then, like you said, really jealously guarding it is crucial. So usually in the weekends, it just means getting up extra early and just putting in that time before, you know, doing other things, doing weekend things.
I've got a lot of listeners that love to hear about particulars in people's writing process and tools that they use. So one thing I've promised is in 2019, we're going to talk more about that kind of stuff. What do you have any special writing tools that you use? Is there an application that you like? Do you just write in Word, or are you a Scrivener user? Are there any things, particulars like that, that really help your process?
Yeah, I definitely use Microsoft Word. I'm not super tech savvy, so I'm not really even that great at using Word for all it can do. But one thing that I do that I don't know, I haven't talked to any other writers who do it this way, and I sometimes even get some weird looks from people when I explain this process. But obviously a book goes through a lot of different rewrites. I like to start a new Word document for every successive draft of a book. And then I like to have both documents open, you know, on either side of the screen. And then every single draft, I'm starting over from page one. And it's, for me, it forces me to look at every single word, because otherwise I would totally copy and paste stuff. And it's, you know, over five or six drafts, it feels kind of like running the story through a filter. And every time it gets a little bit better because I'm able to kind of clarify the thoughts a little more or figure out what's wrong with the scene. It forces me to look really closely. But it also looks really weird because I've got two Word documents open at any one time.
That's fantastic. That's really your style really harkens back to, you know, when writers wrote on typewriters. And when you say that you're doing a second draft of a book, it was literally a second draft. You literally wrote it from page one on, because there's no going into the text and editing. It's rewriting the book. And as word processors have become the norm for us writing in, a lot of authors, when they say they're rewriting a book, what they're actually doing is going through and doing a heavy edit and taking out chunks, or, you know, writing in more detail and things like that. But that, you know, starting from scratch again, even though you have the other one as reference, obviously, what do you think that, well, you said that putting it through a filter, so to speak, as you rewrite the story, do you feel closer to the characters? Do you feel, that you have more control of the story because you are so close to it?
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, the first couple drafts are always really uncomfortable and no fun, because I'm just kind of making it up as I go, and there's no map, and I feel very outside of the story. But with every draft, I feel like I know the story a little better, and I know what I'm trying to do a little better. And I notice in the first couple drafts, I'm solving ginormous problems, like entire chunks of the book just don't work and entire characters don't work. And then with each successive draft, I'm solving smaller and smaller problems. And it's a really good feeling. And it's also a nice feeling to start. I mean, when it comes time to start a new draft, it's a nice feeling to start with a blank page and just be like, you know, okay, fresh start.
I love that. I think that's fascinating. I think some people are probably going to try that after hearing that. Taylor, No Exit is out everywhere now. This is the perfect thriller for the kind of dead of winter that we're in now, because if you want to be scared about the world around you, this is the perfect time to read No Exit. I'm so happy for you that it's coming out right now. Taylor, if folks are just learning about you and your work, is there a place online where they can find you and connect with you? And maybe if they have burning questions about the story, they could post it to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm on Facebook, Taylor Adams Author, at whatever the Facebook URL is. And then I'm on Twitter. Facebook is probably the best way to get a hold of me. And then I've also got a website, again, TaylorAdamsAuthor.com. And you can contact me that way, too. There's a little module that you can use there. And then I will be on January 22nd, I'll be in Arizona at the Poison Pen, doing a signing and an interview. So I'm super excited about that with Tammy Hoag.
Nice. They post a lot of theirs on YouTube. Do you have any idea if they're going to stream it?
You know, I don't know, but probably. I better get a haircut first.
I'll find that and link it in the show notes, and I'll link the Facebook and everything in there. Taylor, it's been so much fun talking with you. I'm super excited for everybody to get their hands on No Exit. I know they're going to love it. You mentioned that you're working on the next book. Is there any little teaser you can give us about what's coming up next?
Yeah, the working title is Hairpin Bridge, and it involves a mysterious suicide on a bridge, interestingly enough.
Dun, dun, dun. That's going to be nice. I can't wait. Yeah. I was looking for an adjective and I didn't have one. Taylor, I wish you much success on the novel, buddy. And, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to come on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to HankGarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
On Walpurgis night, when the moon is high, hell's bells ring and witches must answer. They dapple their breasts with rendered fat of murdered babes, straddle their brooms and take to the sky, as the devil wills, to speed through dreamy midnight air to the summit of the Brockenberg, that haunted peak shrouded in swirling mists, where a glen of gnarled limbs and wan moonlight awaits to host their debauches and blasphemies. Now to the Brocken the witches ride. The stubble is gold and the corn is green. There shall the carnival's sabbat be seen, and the devil shall come to preside. The accuser elopes from the bowels of hell, a sure-footed, goat-headed, many-horned beast with cloven hooves and a staff of bone. He perches upon the witch altar to brood in cerulean half-light, a winged silhouette with watchful red eyes. The witches gather and bow to their master, upon his charred rump give the shameful kiss, then imps beat the drum and a round dance begins. Lash yourselves into frenzy, hags! Pass the chalice of pure marrow broth. Whip the ground with your hair, tread the sky with your feet, dance with joined hands around Satan's cold fire. Then find out a nook of nettles and moss, and lay with the rough-skinned beast of your choosing, suckling some rancid teat of desire. But hist! The cock crows. Away, away! Gather your tatters and broomsticks and wits back to your huts, to your thresholds and hearths, and become once more, at the red break of day, the furtive adder in your neighbor's garden. The ghost host of the Salem Sorcery Tour, dazzling in his steampunk Victorian morning crepe, let the spell he'd woven trail through the twilight air like a hag across the moon, then chirped, "Isn't that silly?" and bowed, sweeping the wet grass with his satin-ribboned top hat. The tour group gave a polite round of applause. Nobody believes that stuff today, but the Puritans sure did. They took witches very seriously. If they went down in the morning and bought eggs, and one was rotten, surely the devil had come in the night, gone boop, tee-hee-hee, then scampered off on his little hooves. And who's in league with the devil? Witches. We're taught that the Puritans were super nice and cute with little buckles on their hats, but it's not the case, folks. They were fanatics. Witch hunts don't happen in a healthy society. They hated kids. They hated women. They were crazy. And that craziness. He turned on the spot, casting a protective circle around the stone garden of the witch memorial. Got these people killed,